I'd like to welcome all of you to the third lecture in our fall lecture series. We try to find fascinating individuals and stimulating topics for each of these lectures, and as you will very shortly be hearing, I feel that we've certainly succeeded in that goal this evening. There are three more lectures in this series, and I want to strongly encourage all of you to come to our next lecture, and in fact, tell all of your friends and neighbors to come to our next lecture. It's going to be given by Dr. Olivia Judson, who is a prominent evolutionary biologist, has written extensively for the New York Times, for the New Yorker, and has written a fascinating, popular book on evolutionary biology called Dr. Tatiana's Guide to Sex for All Creation. And if you want to find out what that's about, you'll have to attend Olivia's lecture to be titled Glad to Have Evolved, and that will be 2 weeks from this evening. So at this point, I would like to introduce Professor Aaron Sachs from the Cornell Department of History, who will be introducing tonight's speaker.
Thanks, Don. Thank you all for being here. I am in the history department. I actually teach environmental history. Some of my students are here, so they can attest to that. Environmental history is a fairly new field, a fairly dynamic field, which really is just a way of saying that nobody really knows what it is. Its contours are still very much being debated. I think some environmental historians would say that it's about how nature has changed over time. Others would say it's about how our ideas of nature have changed over time. I think probably the most interesting environmental historians would say that it's both of those things simultaneously. So far, I think that environmental historians have done a fairly good job of convincing other historical scholars that the environment can no longer be treated simply as a backdrop or as scenery for the really important things that happen in history. If you just think about American history and how it would be different, for instance, if the Eastern Seaboard had not been so densely forested when Europeans first came over, or if Europeans had come over with very different ideas about forests, American history would have looked quite different. I think what environmental historians are still working on is explaining to environmentalists that they need to be historians as well. And you can see this, for instance, if you just think about many of the main concerns of the environmental movement. We know that we need to be concerned about climate change because we've taken a historical look at the way that the concentration of carbon has changed in the atmosphere. But maybe even more important than looking at baselines and examining change over time, I think thinking historically about the environment helps us understand that our society, our culture, our bodies, our minds are inextricable from the environment. At every past moment and at every present moment, we have been and still are shaping nature just as it shapes us. Which leads, I think, to the insight that environmentalism cannot be about simply freezing particular places in time, preserving what we think of as pristine wild ecosystems, but rather environmentalism has to be about a constant process of mutual adaptation. I think David Stradling's work provides outstanding opportunities to dig into these kinds of questions. David has written three books, all excellent, all I would recommend very, very highly. The first one was from 1999, called Smokestacks and Progressives, Environmentalists, Engineers, and Air Quality in America, 1881 to 1951, which does a beautiful job of reminding us that environmental issues aren't just confined to the wilderness, but take place in cities where many of us, most of us, live. It also reminds us that modernity brought with it air pollution. We think of the dawning of modernity as generally a very good thing. It brought all kinds of progress. It also brought smog. And that book does an excellent job of reminding us, in addition, that there were people who cared about things like air pollution even back in the late 19th century. There were environmentalists, or at least proto-environmentalists. David's second book is called Making Mountains, New York City and the Catskills, from 2007. This one does a wonderful job of showing the sometimes subtle but always powerful connections that have existed between city and country in this country, and everywhere, really, but with a nice focus on the relationship between the metropolitan area of New York City and the more famous region of the Catskills that we think of as a beautiful getaway, but which has had things like a tanning industry in it, for instance. And finally, the book that he's going to draw on for today's talk, The Nature of New York, An Environmental History of the Empire State, from 2010. This one, I'll just say quickly, the trend in environmental studies is more and more toward international focuses. And I just want to suggest how important it is still to look at things like environmental issues in the context of a particular state. Of course, pollution crosses boundaries. All sorts of environmental issues cross boundaries and borders. But the study of the environment can be really reinvigorated, I think, when you look at the kinds of debates that happen at the state level. You get more politics this way. You see that the way that people have constantly debated environmental issues at the legislative level. David is currently professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. He also grew up in Cincinnati, but he went to college here in upstate New York at Colgate. And he has even deeper roots in the upstate region. His grandparents were from the Catskills. And I know he has a great affection for all of this region. His topic for tonight is Learning from the Nature of New York, the State and Environmental Policy. I'm really looking forward to hearing it. I hope you'll join me in welcoming him to Cornell.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to Don and to Aaron and also Kevin Moss for making arrangements for me to come, and to Todd Bittman for thinking of me, inviting me to come here. It's always a pleasure to be in New York in September. As a college student, it was always such a pleasure to leave Cincinnati, which had been scorching all summer long, and to come up to Hamilton, which I love dearly. I always have. And to be in New York, it felt to me, honestly, like coming home. And so it's really a pleasure to be in New York again in September. I've been thinking of the Catskills a lot lately. I know other parts of the state have flooded more recently, but I've got strong ties to the Catskills, family connections and scholarly connections, the book that Aaron mentioned, Making Mountains. I studied lots of places in the Catskills as I was writing that book. This includes Margaretville, seen here during the worst of the Irene floods, and Phoenicia in the upper corner, which has been devastated. Phoenicia and the central Catskills have had three so-called 100-year floods since 1996. Many communities in that region, in Ulster, Delaware, and Greene counties, haven't known real prosperity for decades, and they aren't well positioned to recover from such events, let alone a string of them. Perhaps half of Prattsville, flooded by the Schoharie River, has been or will be demolished. I have my doubts about how much of it will be rebuilt. Some people are beginning to wonder if Phoenicia should be rebuilt where it is or perhaps rebuilt elsewhere. Frankly, I think Phoenicia would stop being Phoenicia if it were rebuilt somewhere else. People try to make sense of these kinds of events in different ways. As a historian, I turn to the past. So, is there something to be learned from the Catskills' long history of flooding? I can't help thinking of these folks, the bishops and their patrons at Bishop Falls House in Olive, down the Esopus Creek from Phoenicia. DeForest Bishop, whom I believe is holding the reins on this wagon, and his brother Frank attempted to run a farm owned by their mother, and in their struggle to make the land pay, they opened a boarding house in 1895, adding a clapboard extension to the farm stone house, the stone farmhouse that had been in the family for over 100 years. Their guests rode through the pleasant countryside, swam in the creek, watched the waterfall over the adjacent Bishop Falls, lovely despite the fact that it had old mills on either side. They lounged in the shade around the farmstead and enjoyed the produce of the region, fresh fruit, vegetables, milk, chicken, and eggs. All of this is of interest because DeForest told the story of his family business in great detail before a commission set up by the state to determine the value of all properties taken by New York City to create the Ashokan Reservoir. Bishop Falls was just upstream from the new dam site, and soon the falls themselves, seen here, would be underwater, as would the old house and the farm. This Esopus flood has never subsided. The bishops sold off what they could and sued the city for the best price they could get. And the commission and a room full of lawyers tried to put a value on a plot of land that had been home to a family for five generations, but really didn't make much money. The courts struggled in general to assign worth to rural lifestyles that didn't translate well into business profits and real estate values. Nearly everyone in the takings area essentially scratched by, just as they do today in much of the region. DeForest did all of the family testifying, seemingly stoic and focused on details, the bits of information that could garner the highest compensation, the number of shade trees in the yard, the number of outbuildings, the board feet of lumber that would be needed to replace them somewhere else. All the takings proceedings held in Kingston were sober and formal. In the long trial over the Bishop property, in only one short outburst did emotion overtake reason. John McGrath, a Phoenicia boarding house operator, testifying on behalf of the bishops, got frustrated by questions from the city's lawyer. His outburst got to the heart of the issue. Quoting, "The very name of the place itself is a benefit to that place. The very name of it being Bishop House and being Bishop Falls House and a number of other things like that, there is sentiment, for instance, that was of benefit to these boys, that they could not derive any place else. They have grown up there. I knew their father, and I remember their grandfather. They all lived on this place, and those boys came up there." How does one place a value on the fact that their name was Bishop and this was Bishop Falls? How does one estimate the loss, not just of the house and the business, but also of the falls that bore their name? Nothing I have ever read has convinced me so dearly of the human attachment to place and the overwhelming sense of loss that can come when it is swept away. Like several other destroyed communities, Olive was rebuilt outside the reservoir zone even before the flooding waters of the Ashokan rose. But of course, Bishop Falls weren't replaced, nor was the brothers' business. This was more than a 100-year flood. So what of Phoenicia today? Is there some value that might be gained from looking back at the other Esopus flooding? Something more than syrupy aphorisms about human endurance, rural stoicism, or American adaptability? First, I'll note that the comparison here, Irene and a Shokan flooding, points to the central difficulty of trying to find wisdom in the past. Although some in the Catskills have probably tried, it's difficult to blame New York City for Irene's devastation. Historical analogy is tricky business, but I'll make assertions anyway. We should learn something from the permanence of the Ashokan flood. Irene came and went, but obviously the math that told us that the floods of 1996 and 2005 and 2011 were once-in-a-lifetime events, that math was wrong. Global warming should change our calculations. Although the deadline is considerably more flexible now than it was in 1908 when the city told the bishops they had to leave their home, the people of Phoenicia, the Catskills, and everywhere, really, will eventually have to accommodate themselves to a permanently altered world. Moving farther from flooding waterways will be just a small part of that accommodation. I'd like to focus here this evening on policy, actually, not accommodation, because although there can be no longer can we prevent global warming, we can slow its rate and reduce its consequences. There are lessons to be learned from environmental history, and New York's environmental history in particular, that can help us in these tasks. First, a caveat, although it may come too late, environmental history can be dispiriting. Our past is filled with many troubling stories about human interaction with nature. I remember Bill Cronin teaching environmental history at Wisconsin, reflecting on how his courses seemed to disempower his students, just the opposite of what he intended. Too many of them left his classroom feeling hopeless, not an emotion that leads to action, and not an emotion that Cronin himself felt. So, I'll admit to being highly selective here, taking from the past three stories that have relatively happy endings that led to good decisions. All three allow me to emphasize the importance of citizen activism. I'll not dwell on the obvious fact that righteous activists often lose, and I'll not dwell on the fact that all policies, even good ones, create winners and losers. The reality of global warming looming over this lecture surely adds enough gloom. I want to suggest a better way forward, making use of the past. Here's my argument. Over the last 150 years or so, battles to protect or improve the environment have been more likely to succeed when they made use of powerful images, especially when those images could be combined with scientific knowledge. In each of these stories, citizens and policymakers learned from the environment, using science and art as guides. I'll support this argument with brief discussions of New York State forest policy, the creation of the New York City building codes, and the battle to stop the Storm King power plant. I'll acknowledge that there are no perfect outcomes in democratic policymaking, but I'd like to think that together these stories are empowering. I know that many of you will probably want to talk about hydrofracking, which I would be happy to do in question and answering. I didn't feel comfortable speaking about it at length in the lecture part. I have a feeling that many of you know more about it than I do. First, to the mountains. Even as romantic tourism, First, to the Northwoods. As late as the 1840s, the Adirondacks were largely unvisited, unsettled, and unknown, and rarely discussed in Albany. Increasingly, however, wealthy New Yorkers were expanding their summer tours, heading north on railroads, traveling by boat, and seeking out wilderness retreats in the Adirondacks, fishing, hunting, and escaping the rigors of urban life. These trips, often written about lovingly for private and public audiences, created real connections to this well-wooded place for powerful and influential men, men like Theodore Roosevelt and Charles Dudley Warner. Even as romantic tourism was changing the meaning of the North Woods for many New Yorkers, the Adirondacks were also becoming home to more and more settlers, many of whom worked in the growing timber industry. Not surprisingly, concern for the preservation of the North Woods grew along with the export of wood products. The state's debate about the preservation of forest lands began after the publication of George Perkins Marsh's Man and Nature, or Physical Geography as Modified by Human Action, in 1864. Instantly influential, Marsh argued that human actions had and would continue to exact a heavy toll on nature, claiming even that deforestation had played a role in the decline of great European civilizations. Marsh noted that poetical views on preservation had already sparked some discussion of preserving the North Woods. In his words, it is desirable that some large and easily accessible region of the American soil should remain, as far as possible, in its primitive condition. At once a museum for the instruction of the student, a garden for the recreation of love of nature, and an asylum where indigenous tree and humble plant that loves the shade and fish and fowl and four-footed beast may dwell and perpetuate their kind. Still, Marsh was much less influenced by romantic thinking than by his understanding of what would become the science of ecology. Marsh connected deforestation with diminished water flow, and he specifically warned against the destruction of the Adirondack forests, which were just beginning to see considerable logging. This image, by the way, shows a widely used logging technique in the North Woods. The water level has been raised on Cranberry Lake, killing lakeside trees, but allowing loggers to send logs more easily down the river and out of the wilderness. Marsh didn't write at length about New York, but he warned, quote, "The felling of the Adirondack woods would ultimately involve for northern and central New York consequences similar to those that which have resulted from the laying bare of the southern and western declivities of the French Alps," which he claimed had been a part of the decline of those civilizations around the Mediterranean. Without forests, Marsh thought, erosion would silt the Hudson, temperatures would become more erratic and the mountains drier. Thus, Marsh argued that the, quote, collateral advantages of the preservation of these forests would be far greater than those for nature recreation and study. Marsh's work sparked a growing concern about deforestation and the possibility of diminished water flow in some of the state's most important rivers, especially the Hudson. Others noted that the northern waters were critical to the state's canal system, which still carried freight inexpensively from Albany to Buffalo despite the growing importance of railroads. This commercial argument for forest preservation, based on a scientific understanding of the relationship between water and forested mountains, gained political support, especially in New York City. A drought in 1883 left the upper Hudson perilously low, adding a sense of urgency to the debate. With the backing of the New York City Chamber of Commerce, the state legislature took action. In 1884, it created a temporary forest commission to investigate conditions in the state's mountain ranges. Led by well-known Harvard forester Charles Sargent, the commission directed most of its attention toward the Adirondacks, but members also toward the Catskills. In its 1885 report to the State Assembly, the commission recommended the creation of a forest preserve in the northern mountains and proposed a bill that prohibited the sale or lease of state lands in enumerated counties. As an aside, I'll note that the commission did not recommend the creation of the forest preserve in the Catskills, since those mountains had already seen considerable logging and because they contained, quote, no streams of more than local influence. Obviously, the commission failed to foresee that the Catskills would one day provide 90% of New York City's water. The commission's report convinced the state legislature to act quickly, and it created the Forest Preserve later that year, 6 years before Congress passed legislation allowing the President of the United States to set aside federal forest reserves. New York's Preservation Act listed counties in which state-owned forest lands would remain in public domain and therefore be, quote, forever kept as wild forest lands, a phrase that became one of the most repeated in New York State history. A new three-person state forest commission appointed by the governor would oversee the management of the preserve. Although the state's focus has been on the Adirondacks all along, state lands in three Catskills counties, Greene, Ulster, and Sullivan, also joined the forest preserve. At its creation in 1885, the preserve included 681,000 acres in the Adirondacks and just 34,000 acres in the Catskills. Famously, in 1894, the popularity of the preserve became evident when New Yorkers added the wild forever stipulation to the state constitution, which now barred logging on state lands in the forest preserve counties. Creating the forest preserve and adding to the protective phrases to the state's constitution marked just the beginning of preservation in New York's mountain forests. In 1902, concerned citizens, mostly downstate residents with recreational interests in the mountains, created the Association for the Preservation of the Adirondacks. In the interest of preserving the Adirondack forests, water, game, fish, and maintenance of healthful conditions in the Adirondack region. The association helped keep the Adirondacks in the press and kept pressure on the legislature to pass protective measures and add acreage to the preserve through purchase. By 1904, the state owned 1.4 million acres in the Adirondacks and over 100,000 acres in the Catskills. Much of this forest land covered higher elevations, land that was least valuable to loggers and potentially most valuable to protecting watersheds. What I'd like to emphasize in this story, beyond the importance of fledgling ecological science, is the public's sense of this place. In this instance, by public, I mean mostly the politically connected and financially secure New Yorkers, many of them in Manhattan, who knew the Adirondacks mostly as a spectacular vacation spot, not as a place where people made or should make a living. Beyond this, city residents who hadn't had the pleasure of visiting the Adirondacks themselves certainly knew the place through the most popular imagery of the era. Landscape paintings. Although other places in New York gained more attention from the great artists, more about which in a moment, the Adirondack region became a popular subject among landscapists, especially the eastern region around Lake George and Schroon Lake, areas easily reached from the city. Cole, Durand, Kensett, Church, all the great 19th century painters created Adirondack canvases. I'm just giving you a sample, of course, of canvases and artists. These images, seen over and over again in the homes of wealthy New Yorkers, in the galleries and public spaces of Manhattan, on steamships and in hotel lobbies, in lithograph form, in cheap calendars and wall hangings, in magazines on China patterns, these images of Northwood's wilderness, of stunning Adirondack waters, they played a significant role in convincing the public that preservation was a worthy cause. These places were worthy of protection. Art and science worked together. Let me turn to my second example. Tenement reform. Housing the poor is an ancient urban problem. It was increasingly discussed in New York through the decades of remarkable growth in the 19th century. Dense working class neighborhoods subject to contagious diseases, cholera outbreaks, most problematic, had long gained the attention of reform-minded New Yorkers. Still, problems persisted, although cholera saw its last major outbreak in New York in 1866. Some early reforms were critical to protecting human life, but clearly less successful in uplifting impoverished urban lives. A real leap forward in policy awaited the activism of Jacob Riis, a journalist who used his experience on the police beat to familiarize himself with the living conditions in New York City's poorest neighborhoods. Although many others came before him and worked with him, Rees became the nation's most important voice for housing reform when he published How the Other Half Lives in 1890. A long essay that described conditions in the various immigrant neighborhoods, How the Other Half Lives was based on a stereopticon show, an early slideshow, that featured dozens of his photographs of tenement dwellers. At first, the book contained only line drawings, copies of the photographs, but as the book became a sensation and technology allowed the publication of photographic halftones, more and more New Yorkers began to see how the other half lived. The images were remarkably effective when coupled with Rees's powerful prose. In one passage, he described the effect of summer's heat, which forced families outside, onto tenement roofs, onto fire escapes, and into the streets. Disease became virulent in the hottest months, and deaths visited too many families. Readers could visualize the sleepless mothers Rees described walking, quote, the streets in the gray of the early dawn, trying to stir a cooling breeze to fan the brow of a sick baby. Although he was hardly the first to write extensively about the evils of tenement districts, Rees was the most effective, and How the Other Half Lives became one of the most important books of the 19th century. This work helped focus attention on failed urban environments, making clear that improving people's lives would require improving the places where they lived. Thinking people could have guessed how badly the other half lived, but now they didn't have to. They had images, powerful images, that showed cramped quarters, a lack of privacy, a troubling mixing of work and home spaces, the dark and dank quarters of New York's poverty. Middle-class New Yorkers were moved by what they saw. And here you get a sense of what was really special about Rees's work is he worked with flash photography, which was just a brand new technology. And so he's bringing the flash bulbs into, in this case, a basement illegal saloon, and showing people places that literally had never been shown to those who hadn't visited in person. In partial response to Rees and other reformers, and a growing understanding that healthful environments needed fresh air and sunlight, in 1901, the state passed a comprehensive tenement house law, regulating everything from stairwells to fire escapes to lighting, ventilation, and plumbing. In total, the code was 40 pages long, with 165 sections, revealing how intimately involved in regulating the urban environment the state had become. The law's length and specificity also revealed how dramatic the market's failure had been. In booming cities with continuously arriving newcomers, property owners had too little market incentive to keep their tenants safe. While the law couldn't instantly improve the lives of the urban poor, it was a start. At the very least, it codified society's expectations about how Americans ought to live. Images, I would argue, were critical to this success. One more story concerning public activism, the role of imagery, and a growing use of science in environmental policymaking. This concerns Storm King, the battle in the 1960s over a proposed plant. In 1962, Consolidated Edison announced plans for the world's largest pumped storage facility at Cornwall. You see the image there. There at a massive rock face that plunged into the Hudson, Con Edison would pump the river's brackish water up through the mountain, Storm King, to a reservoir. When demand spiked during summer days, for example, the water would be released to generate power. Since electricity would be needed to pump the water up the mountain, the new plant wouldn't generate any additional power, but it would allow Con Edison to forego building new plants to cover peak demand. The Storm King proposal sparked immediate protest from conservation organizations concerned about Hudson River scenery and historic landscapes. The project would scar Storm King itself and, at least in the initial incarnation, require the building of huge transmission towers that would mar even more of the Highlands scenery. To battle the proposed plan, activists gathered at the home of Carl Carmer, who had written the Hudson River volume and the Rivers of America series back in 1939. This is not the original cover of that 1939 book. That meeting led to the creation of a new collaboration, Scenic Hudson Preservation Conference. Scenic Hudson hoped to block Con Edison's plan by convincing the Federal Power Commission not to issue a permit because it would cause aesthetic damage. As the law required, the FPC held a series of public hearings. At hearings in Washington in 1964, Carmer offered his defense of the Hudson, emphasizing the historic importance of the river and especially the scenery, which had long inspired great art and, he noted, continued to do so. Supporters of the power plant argued that it represented the march of progress. But Carmer questioned a definition of progress that included marring such a place. Instead, Carmer argued that progress is made when people preserve their inheritance of scenic, historic, and recreational values. Carmer poetically captured the growing environmentalist sentiment, one that linked historic and natural preservation in an effort to control growth and limit the damaging effects of development, especially around expanding cities. "There is ominous talk along the Hudson today," he warned. "Talk from self-appointed oracles who declare the march of cities inevitable. In only a few years, we are told, the city of New York may stride like a wild, irresistible monster in mile by mile steps up the great river of the mountains. Soon the clamor of machines may be echoing from the Palisades. Soon the noiseless deeps below the peaceful highlands may be sucked into the maw of the city." It's one of my favorite phrases, the maw of the city. Clearly, Carmer knew that more than just Con Edison's plans threatened to transform the Hudson Valley. Despite Carmer's vivid testimony, the FPC seemed inclined to support the new plant. But each hearing brought new publicity and increasing awareness of the impact this facility would have on a beloved landscape. In turn, opposition grew. More activists, even beyond New York, came to believe, as Carmer did, that all of America stands at a crossroad at the Hudson. Being what it is should be the spear point of the national drive against all agencies that would separate our people from their love of the American landscape as it has always been. When the FPC did grant a permit, the Scenic Hudson sued, claiming that the commission had ignored relevant environmental and historical evidence. In its ruling, Scenic Hudson versus Federal Power Commission, the United States Court of Appeals, Second Circuit, agreed that federal law required that the FPC hear complete testimony, noting, among other things, that the commission had failed to make a study of alternatives to Storm King. The court also agreed that the Hudson Highlands had, quote, unique beauty and, quote, major historical significance. And indeed, that stretch of the Hudson offered, quote, one of the finest pieces of river scenery in the world. As an aside, and an important one, in addition to sending the issue back before the FPC, the court established the right of Scenic Hudson to sue in the matter, noting that the group easily qualified as an aggrieved party. Henceforth, according to the Scenic Hudson ruling, the environmentalist point of view had legal standing, an outcome that allowed the flowering of environmental law and by itself ensured the lasting significance of the Storm King battle. But for our purposes here, what interests me most is the importance of imagery in the language of the defense of Storm King and the court's decision. Historical significance and unique beauty intertwined in the Hudson Highlands. I'll use the words of another prominent opponent to the plant, Robert Boyle, to explain. Boyle was a journalist who published an early environmental pieces in Sports Illustrated. An avid angler, Boyle helped create the Hudson River Fishermen's Association in 1966, the Fishermen's Association eventually became morphed into the Riverkeepers. Hoping to alert FPC to potential fisheries damage that would be caused by the water intake system at Storm King. In battling Storm King, Boyle studied the Hudson completely, perhaps more completely than anyone ever had. He studied the river's ecology, firsthand mostly, out on the water. He studied the river's history too, and he wrote it up in a beautiful book, The Hudson River, A Natural and Unnatural History, published in 1969, still one of my favorite books. Although Boyle thought the science concerning the Hudson's fisheries should suffice to stop the plant, in the end it was probably the imagery, which he captured beautifully, that won the day. Boyle's book opens, "To those who know it, the Hudson River is the most beautiful, messed up, productive, ignored, and surprising piece of water on the face of the earth. There is no other river quite like it. And for some persons, myself included, no other river will do. The Hudson is the river." Chapter 1, simply titled The River, goes on to describe the changing landscapes along the Hudson. Boyle writes of the, quote, "soaring cliffs of the Palisades, the slumbering heights of the highlands, and the distant vistas of the Catskills. Though the scenes vary," he continues, "they have a common theme, a sort of fairy tale magic that lingers in the mind from childhood. The notion that this is the way the world ought to look."